Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of First Do Battalion Chief, and I hope all are doing well with this this new world that we're living in. But hopefully, this too shall pass soon enough. But tonight, we got a really good show in store. I invited Deputy Assistant Chief Frank Lieb from the FDNY to come on and share his experience with us. With the he's involved with the UL, the Fire Dynamics Boot Camp, and he was actually very instrumental in getting the article published that I had published in Fire Engineering, and I did the same, pretty much the same article with NYF, and Frank was very helpful in not only getting the getting me to do the article, but also in getting the whole thing, hosted by the FDNY. So anyway, without further ado, Frank, you're on the air there.
Hey, Dan, I'm here. Thanks a lot for having me tonight. Appreciate it.
Frank, no, it's my pleasure. Congratulations. You just recently were promoted to Deputy Assistant Chief. You're now in charge of the FDNY Fire Academy, which is quite a career landmark. And I can't think of a better guy to be in that spot. So how's it going so far with the heading up here, the Fire Academy?
Hey, so I appreciate that, Dan. And, it's quite an honor to head up the Fire Academy for the FDNY. I mean, we're blessed to have just amazing world-class instructors there. So they asked me to become the acting chief of the Fire Academy pending promotion back in late February. And then 27 days later, we shut down training for the virus. So it was, okay, where do we go from here? I had been very familiar with training. I've been involved with different training initiatives at the Fire Academy for the better part of a decade. So I knew where I could make an impact in different training initiatives that we do and staffing and in other minor regards. And then suddenly everything was turned upside down. So we're now, I'm happy to report, we are now back up and running in what I would say how we'll operate in the post-pandemic world, which is significantly different than we operated prior to COVID-19 with some of the units that we now have up and running. So we're bringing in our hands-on units, our tactical training, our subway, our ropes, our tactical training. We're doing all of that. A couple of units a day are coming to the Fire Academy, but we've started doing other programs where we're doing a lot more remote learning and distant learning, particularly with our promotional classes. And then we have a new unit that's called a remote tactical training unit. And that unit will have a demonstration on WebEx, and we will have about 10 units that will watch that live online via the WebEx. We'll send them a link so they could watch that drill that's another company is doing hands-on, or we have a unit from our tactical unit doing the drill, right, and then everybody else is watching it. They could ask questions. They could mute at the end of the drill. They could raise their virtual hand in it, which that's not happening too much because we're still having issues with teaching everybody to sign on to the new technology. So there is a learning curve that goes with this. Could just type in a question and ask you. So it's been very successful so far, and training's able to actually reach down into units more frequently than we were previously. So, we're modernizing training going forward in a hybrid fashion.
Yeah. You know, I just a thought popped into my head as you were saying that. WNYF is pretty much worldwide. I mean, people all over the world read the NYF. I mean, they get it delivered to their house, and it's amazing. There's guys that I talk to that aren't on our job that know just about as much as job as that we do. Is there any thoughts to opening up that WebEx to other departments in other cities? I mean, because the FDNY isn't held in such high regard and such high esteem that being that it's virtual, is that a down the road kind of thought? Like at some point sharing the knowledge with like bigger cities like Baltimore or Chicago?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And so at the current time, that's not a consideration, and primarily because we're trying to get this to be the best possible format right now internally.
Right.
But the other initiative, so we turned one of the buildings into a video production unit. So there's departments all around the country that have – so we have a video production unit at headquarters. So they're very good at producing a lot of content, but we needed something more at the Fire Academy because we have to pivot and make so much more content for some of the online learning delivery. So, you know,
right.
Possibly some of the videos could become available down the road, but that's decisions that would have to be made in concert with – many other people above my level.
Right. Sure. Is that now? I remember when building 12 was built, and then we all thought that was going to be the new training academy, and then it was, I don't know, we were informed that it wasn't going to be used for training. It's only the ropes and I don't know, some hazmat stuff. Is that where the virtual training is taking place right now? In that building 12 or
no? So building what would be building 15, which is the trailer that housed the ERP unit previously. So we changed that over and put all the video equipment in there. But the idea is we're going to outfit all of our rooms so we can view or broadcast from any one of the locations that we have. You know, so we're really changing to modernize training. I mean, you look at the fire service or any public agency where we typically lag when it comes to technology, and it's hard for us to always have the latest technology. But the coronavirus has enabled us to be at the forefront with some of these technologies and utilizing them in some cases in ways they may not have been designed to be used, but we're using them in very effective delivery methods.
Right. So it's almost like that old saying where it says that when one door closes, a window opens or another door opens. So maybe because our hand was forced, that maybe this is something that could actually be a bigger benefit in the long run, you know, like this using technology to train, you know. So
yeah, and I look back and some of the people that I've worked with at the Fire Academy, like Chief Hodgins, right, who, you know, I know you
right.
know well, when he was at the Fire Academy prior to him retiring, he loved the idea of more remote training and online training and stuff like this, but we didn't have something to drive it forward, right? So the opportunity was born really out of the virus to modernize
right.
the training and get the buy-in that you need, you know, so that's the hardest hurdle, right, is getting the initial buy-in to get you over that the threshold. To make it where it's widely accepted and embraced.
Right. Yeah. So, well, you know, change, it goes without saying in the fire service, or, you know, I'll speak for ourselves with the FDNY, is something that is not easy in the fire department. Like, as a testimony, I mean, we're still using journals on the house watch, you know, so that to me is like kind of this symbolic of how we're kind of reluctant to change, you know. So, but the nice thing about the FDNY, they say it's like, you know, trying to turn around the aircraft carrier. But once the change happens, the guys are great. They usually embrace it, you know, pretty quickly. I'll tell you personally from my perspective, I see the young guys coming in, and I'm still in the field. I mean, so, you know, when I go into the kitchen or I go visit other firehouses, that diamond plate kiosk is always on. I mean, guys are, you know, it's great. They're taking the initiative on their own to train. And they're asking me a lot of questions. You know, hey, Chief, what do you think about this? And, you know, how would you do this on the roof? And, you know, what about this? And it's all on diamond plate. So the guys, because they're millennials, I guess, it's a new generation, they're very receptive to this kind of training. So this may actually, in the future of the fire department with the because all the older guys, like myself or whatever, you know, we're kind of on the way out, you know, and we have to kind of look 5 years ahead or 10 years ahead, and this may be it, you know, this may be the way of the future, right? This
well,
virtual
so the new firefighters are tech natives, right? So they've been born into a world that has technology, so it's not foreign to them. like it is for you or I, where we have to adjust to it. So
right.
That's a big thing. But we've seen most of our senior members have adjusted to this and done quite well. Sure, there are certainly people that are slower to adjust, and, you know, we have to spend a little bit more time with them. But, you know, change is good. I mean, in my office, I have a framed picture of a bunch of firefighters from the olden days, and it says, you know, there's two things that firefighters hate. They hate change, and they hate the way things are. So, you know, you got to have it both ways. But you think about it in your career. You think about the changes that we've seen in our equipment and in the fire ground. I mean, the bottom line is, you know, we're not going out to a horse-drawn buggy. You know, so those firefighters, when the engine was introduced, probably weren't all that excited about it. You know,
they weren't.
You know, when we got bunker gear, I remember when we got bunker gear, right? Shortly after the Watch Street fire that killed three of our firefighters. And there was, you know, there wasn't an immediate embrace of bunker gear. You know, hoods aren't that old. The thermal imaging camera's not that old. The rabbit tool, the bunny tool. The evolution in the fire service, we evolve continuously, really. You know, we don't give ourselves credit for the evolution that we actually do. We just, and rightfully so, the fire service is very conservative to adopt the latest and greatest, because you've seen so many different ideas that sounded good but just weren't practical. So we evaluate everything, and before we embrace it, it has to prove itself on the fire ground and in research. And I think that's a good thing, that we don't just pick up the latest gadget and run with it.
Yeah, that's a great statement. You know, one thing I can tell you from firsthand experience is that, you know, there seems to be like, I don't know if it's a good analogy, cat and mouse. It's just like, you know, things in the street change. You know, I remember going back 35 years, you know, like different types of locks, different types of roofs, different types of windows, like thermal pane windows. That was, I remember when that change happened, you know, and that happened in concert with the bunker gear and the rabbit tool, and all this stuff was going on at the same time. And it took us a long time to kind of adjust, because, you know, engines were used to the truck company going up, and we'd force the door with the irons. And if it was a difficult door, you know, we'd be banging away. And, you know, then they got in with this rabbit tool and we got bunker gear on. They're popping the door in like 5 seconds. They're in the apartment way deeper than we ever went with the rubber boots on. And, you know, we took a few hits on that, you know, because the timing was off, because we didn't have it down yet, you know. And it took a while, but I think we have it down now, you know. So I think it's just the nature of the fire service. It's just that it's constantly in flux. Things are changing. Different materials. And I guess this is a great way to segue into the boot camp, because that was a phenomenal week. What was it, 3 days or whatever it was, 3 or 4 days.
It felt like a week because it was an immersion class, right? So it felt like a week because we were together all day long for dinner and then after dinner. So it was, you know, and that's the idea of it, right, to have you all together learning.
Right. So I have to let the audience know that you actually came up with the title, because we were sitting down and we're trying to scratch our heads and what are we going to call this? And you just said evolution, not revolution, because again, everyone's afraid of change. And, you know, everyone that took the class, and we know there was a few old timers there that were a little vocal and entertaining at the same time. And, you know, they're afraid of this change, you know, but, You nailed it when you said it's evolution, not revolution. And it's like the natural progression of how the fire service is going. So, you know, in the first days, I think, you know, when we first got together, we talked about some of the challenges in the fire service today. And it's no secret that, you know, the war years are long gone. I mean, I caught the very tail end of the war years. And it's so funny. You know, when I got to 17 truck and they had two sections and crazy busy, and they told me when I got there in 86 that, you know, I missed it. You know, you should have been here 10 years ago, right? So, you know, I kind of grew up feeling that way, that, like, you know, I should have been there 10 years ago. But the numbers of fire, you know, the number of fires are way down since the 70s, like by more than half. And there was a comment made by Dan, I think, that firefighters can't go to enough fires anymore to put all the pieces together. So they're not getting enough experience, just through no fault of their own, but it's just the nature of what's happening is that we can't get enough experience anymore because it's just not there. And then experience and knowledge must coexist. You can't gain experience if you don't know what's happening, and you need to know the how to go with the why. So, you know, so this is a challenge for you as being chief of the New York City Fire Academy is that, you know, how do we have 10,000 firefighters, give or take, and, you know, for every guy to have a nozzle job, you know, 10 times a year, that would be an inordinate amount of fires. I mean, we just, there's no way we could go to that many fires, you know. So how do we keep guys sharp and at the same time, you know, keeping sharp with that, with the decrease in the fire load, you know, that seems to be a big challenge, not only in our department, but I would say the whole country must be kind of faced with that dilemma.
Yeah. And that's a good question. Maybe even a little bit of a loaded question, because that's certainly, a dilemma that everybody faces, right? Is how do you stay sharp and current when all the different things that we have to do, you know, not just firefighting anymore. So, as you rightly pointed out, fires are down from the, you know, from the war years, but where our number of runs are up, and the variety of stuff we go to has certainly evolved over the years, right? So we truly are in all hazards. We go to literally everything nowadays, and a lot of it. So for us, you know, you mentioned how do we get experience? How do we do that, right? So how do we, you know, so we have our post-incident review unit and our after-action reviews, and, you know, we have some really great people ahead of those units and work with them. And what they do is they, as you know, Dan, they put together the lessons learned or reinforced from these fires to kind of pass those experiences, transfer them from the people who were at that fire to others who weren't, so we can increase the Rolodex or the hard drive slides of people. So when you show up to something that's similar, you have yours, you now can own it to a lesser degree, of course, but you now own that as one of your own slides that you can compare it to. And that's especially important for the company officer or the chief officer when you go to something. And that talks about that why that you talk about, right? You know, we have to explain the why. The why in the procedures is what enables our firefighters to think and to react in real time on the fire ground and operate in the gray areas, the areas that are not well-defined in our procedures. That's where firefighters make their money, is operating in those gray areas. And by enabling them with the why, right, that's how we make thinking firefighters and fire officers, which is our greatest asset on the fire ground.
Yeah, yeah. You know, like, you just remind me of a story. This guy I worked with, Billy Lawson, 17 truck, he was by far one of the best firemen I ever worked with. And I always used to joke with him, like, you know, I always felt like he had ESP. Like, he was so intuitive. Like, he just had a sixth sense about him. And I just remember on more than one occasion where I remember him distinctly grabbing me one time and saying, I had a nickname, I won't repeat it, but he said, this don't feel right. And he grabs me. He grabs me, and the building fell down. And then we were in Harlem another time, and he said the same thing. He said it to me and the everyone that was around him. He said we were just in there working. It was a vacant building, and he just looked at us and he says, "Let's move back. This don't look right." And the whole exposure floor, the whole wall, just came down on a 90 degree angle. So that intuitiveness, it's hard to teach that. But I like what you said about the slides, because I use that analogy often. That, you know, my brain won't know the difference if it's something that I experienced or if it's something I read. when it's hitting the fan. Because all it's going to do is it's going to search my computer and say, okay, that smoke looks pretty nasty, black. I think it's going to flash over. And it doesn't matter if I saw it in a video, if I did it myself, or if I read about it. It's the slide is there. You know, and we have to create slides. That's what we're looking to do, is create slides, you know.
So, yeah, that's absolutely correct. And there's lots of ways to do that.
Yeah, so just to jump back in time a little bit. So, you know, when I came on the job, you know, I went to a truck company, and, you know, it was drilled into us. Lattice 3, nothing shall deter the roof man from getting the roof. I mean, they said even if they're throwing babies out the window, you're getting the roof. Like, you got the roof, you get the roof, you know. And, you know, we always just took a lot of these things at face value. Like, never open – like, I wasn't in an engine, but I know that they would say – the old-timers would say, like, never open the nozzle on smoke. Whip the nozzle around clockwise to push the smoke and heat out the windows. And this is a biggie. And I tell you what, this came about 20 years ago. I remember a captain, Marty Monahan, was a big advocate of this, about the door closing. Like, he was a big advocate about getting that door closed. And I was taught, don't ever let it close. Like, put a chock under it, you know, and make sure that door stays open so we don't get caught. And the last one was, you know, if we're not making progress in 20 minutes, rethink our strategy. We all know that that's going to change because building construction and everything else has changed. So, you know, so the firefighter getting the roof, you know, I could tell you it was really very tangible. I remember one time we were at a job in Beekman and Oak, and the captain, he was a real – this is Dave Maxwell. He was a real old Bushwick guy. And, you know, he looks at me, he says, did you feel that? And I'm like, you know, yeah, I knew something changed. He says, they just opened the roof, you know, they just popped the bulkhead. And you could really, you know, once I was cognizant of it and I was aware of what was happening, you could really feel the difference when the bulkhead was open as opposed to it, like, when they hadn't got the bulkhead, you know. So they did in the UL, I think they did a series of tests in a one story, and they were talking about, and correct me, about a roof opening not being effective. Do you remember that one segment that we watched about them cutting a roof vent and actually not doing anything?
Yeah, so then it depends on the roof size, depends on the area below, depends on where the fire is. So there's a lot of depends, you know, in that, right? As always, right? There's a lot of variables. Rarely is there a silver bullet. I'll give you, for instance, right? So we're in the process. One of the things we learned from the Fire Dynamics Boot Camp, from some of the people there, is that our ventilation bulletin and some of our and some of the stuff that we have, right? We've have a decades, you know. We go back more than 10 years with Dan Majakowski, right, when he was working for NIST before UL. When we, the FDNY, contacted him to ask him about some of the fires that we were experiencing, right? We were getting a lot of people burnt in flow path, what we now know of flow path injuries. You know, and he had done investigations, particularly for Vandalia Avenue. And some of the early stuff we did with the Chicago Fire Department, long before I was involved with any of the research. But what we learned, one of the things, was we don't have a fire dynamics training bulletin. So basically our ventilation bulletin was like we started at Chapter 5 of what would be a fire dynamics bulletin. And we teach the probies, the new firefighters get this information in probie school. But we didn't do a good job of making a document that talks about this.
Right.
So I have Battalion Chief Timmy Keenan is now working on that document. And we're going to have a fire dynamics training bulletin in the next several months. And that time when we take that roof, right, when we open that roof, vertical vent, we're going to call that time because it feels like it gets better, right? Mm-hmm. But that's only a temporary improvement. Right, there's a time frame for that, and it's hard to tell what that time frame is. But we're going to name that and recognize that, you know, there is a time frame that you have to get water on the fire, And it's got to be coordinated within that time zone, you know, within a small area of time. So, but
right.
we're able to do that in the FDNY, perhaps, you know, and utilize that temporary improvement time, right, because of the staffing
right.
that we have. But it has to be coordinated, because if you just let it go, and
right.
without coordinating it. You know, we're gonna have a problem. So, you know, like I said, we named that the temporary improvement period, where
right.
you know, and that's gonna be followed by a rapid deterioration of conditions if we don't have the hose line operated, and doesn't occur at or near the same time.
Gotcha.
Again, we have the staffing that we're able to tell the roof firefighter, yeah, go to the roof and vent unless you hear that we don't want you to vent. So if the line is having a hard time getting into position, then we need to not do that, because we have a case study from 1994, the Watch Street fire.
Yeah.
Where
right.
where you know, this is before a lot of the studies were done, but you know, in that fire, that was a three-story building, in Manhattan, lower Manhattan, where we lost three firefighters, Captain John Drennan, James Young, and Chris Seidenberg. When the fire came up, they were on the floor above, and the flow path came up. So it was by no fault of ours, the skylight had vented, and the fire came up where they were operating. So the fire was going to the ventilation. So the temporary improvement period would be very short. In that, especially in that particular
right.
case, but water was not being right. applied to the fire when that was going on, and we now realize, certainly more than we did in 1994, what had happened. So that's the fire that's credited with the FDNY of us getting bunker gear, because we got bunker
right.
gear within 6 months of that fire.
Got it. Let me take a second, Frank. If, I'm talking with Deputy Assistant Chief Frank Lee from the FDNY, if you're just joining us. If you want to call in and talk to Frank or myself, the number is 760-454-8852. So, Frank, I'll tell you not a funny story. It's a story that has haunted me for the last 30-some-odd years, 34 years. I was with another probie. We had a fire in a brownstone. And this is always like I can never get my head around what happened. And it was actually, we had a captain, covering captain working. He was a legendary guy that went through the war years. He was he was from 19 truck, and he just, Tony Alva, he just was like the real deal, you know? And, Our lieutenant was working in the engine, and it was a second job now. We were going to this brownstone, and the fire was in the first floor, in the rear. And I think back, like, what must have happened. So the OV went to the rear, and I think he must have opened the door to do a search, right, because the fire was in the rear. And the captain, he grabbed me and the other probie, and he says, "Get out." And he's like, he's very emphatic. Like he said, and we were like dumbfounded. He says, "Get out, like now." And we turned around, and the fireball came like roaring down the hallway, and it just blew over our heads, you know? And what was interesting is that the roof man, the roof firefighter, was from the engine, because me and the other guy were just a probie. And he took the interior stairs. And he never got the roof. He wound up having to jump out the window, and he almost got killed himself. And I wonder, you know, I always was troubled by what happened, you know, and I'm curious as if he had gone up the, let's say we were both tower ladders, so if he had gotten the roof, you know, let's say via the tower ladder, and he actually did get the roof, I wonder what that would have done to us, if that would have precipitated the flashover earlier, or if it was just when the OV opened the door. He opened the back door, the front door was open. We were right in the middle of, like, between the I guess we were like in the living room, and this thing just exploded. And, you know, they thought we were dead, and the fire, I just remember came like roaring over our heads, you know, and it was only by the grace of God that we're alive, you know. So, you know, and things like that weren't talked about, though. Like, we kind of just shook it off and, you know, we never even discussed it. Like, it was no after-action reviews. There was no, like, anyone, you know, did any inquiry on it, like a near miss. It was just like just another day in the 14th Battalion, you know. And it's very similar to the Cherry Road,
like, Washington,
yeah,
D.C.
Cherry Road. Yeah, yeah, very similar. I mean, I could still replay the whole series of events in my head. You know, I had the can. I was in about 20 feet, and our lieutenant came barreling out, and Tony was just like, "Get out!" And we just made it out, like just barely made it out. Like the fire just like roared out, you know. And but I always question as to like what the impact of that roof was never vented. If that actually saved us, or, you know, what impact it had at all, you know. Very interesting. So.
Yeah, and if you had that fire today, right, we would do a post-incident review on it, and we would certainly talk to our friends in the scientific research community and ask them and pose these questions to them and say, hey, you know, what do you think, you know, what do you think, you know, what do you think happened? Because we want to learn, right? We want to be the best firefighters we can. And it's a unique time frame in the fire service. When you think about the amount of scientific research that is being done in fire dynamics, but not only fire dynamics. I mean, look at the cancer research, right? That has really helped us push the ball and really raise the bar for cancer awareness and some of the stuff that we must be doing to better protect ourselves. So, you know, so all of this research coupled with our experience just makes all of our procedures that much better, right? When you can combine both of them, I mean, it's a force multiplier for us being able to keep our firefighters as safe as possible on the fire ground.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one thing about that brownstone, I would imagine that the fire load probably wasn't that heavy, because this is 1986 and there was no plastics. You know, it was probably a couch and a chair and a TV, let's say. You know, it was nothing like anything styrofoam or styrene or anything like that. It was just old furniture, you know.
Yeah, so maybe you would have had that temporary improvement period that would have been a little bit longer than it is today. But eventually, absent of water on the fire, any ventilation that we do is going to enable the fire to get bigger without us putting water on it. So, you know, the days of haphazardly venting, I mean, we could vent and move the fire around the building any way we want. If we want to vent and leave the door open, we could pull the fire into a specific room if we want. You know, we can,
right?
We affect the fire and the flow path of that fire and the smoke within the structure by opening and closing doors, or are taking windows and bulkheads and stuff like that. And even the front door, right, is ventilation, and if the hose line's not there, right? So we want to come in with that hose line, vent opposite, and give the products of combustion a place to go, right? By whipping the hose line and training air and putting it out, you know, and pushing it out the window. Think about the water bottle experiment that we did, right, at the boot camp, where, you know, you took a piece of paper, rolled it up, put it on the edge, and tried to blow it in the water bottle, and you couldn't do it. Right?
Right,
there's no ventilation. But if you put a hole in the back of it, and you blow that piece of paper, and now it goes in, right?
Yeah.
So that's using air entrainment, and what we sometimes refer to as pushing fire, pushing all of those products, pushing them right out the window, and ventilation opposite, where the hose line's coming in, where we chock that door because the line is going in. Well, that's good because we have ventilation opposite that hose line in that scenario.
Right. Yeah, that's
as opposed
what I was,
to going
I was
down
taught.
A project hallway where we don't have ventilation, and now we're whipping that line around, or we have an exterior line going in, and we whip it around and we entrain that air. That's not good. That's when air entrainment is to our disadvantage, and that's when we're going to create bigger problems for ourselves when we do that. So knowing when to and when not to entrain air in our hose stream is an important tactical consideration and something that we need to have a great awareness of on the fire ground.
There's another point here, control the access door. You know, okay, so I got promoted to lieutenant in 1995, right? I was in Flips, and Flips was out at the Rock. And we had these guys from upstate New York. There was 15 of them and 15 of us, right? So, you know, we're all cowboys, right? FDNY. We all want to make the grabs. We all want to be the, it's all this bravado, right? So they filmed us, right? This was a great drill. We laughed so hard when we watched this because we actually saw how, you know, change was good, you know, like, and what I'm getting at is that, you know, when we used to do our searches, right, you'd have the officer, the can, and the irons, and you all go in, and everyone just goes their separate ways, and then, you know, we'll try to cover the whole room. And the instructors were trying to convince us that we should keep a guy, control the door, and be like a beacon, right? So he'd be like our way out, and the other two guys would go in and do the search, and then he would maintain the door, you know? And we're like, come on, we ain't doing that, you know? So they actually videoed us doing it, right? And it's still to this day makes me laugh, like what some of the guys were doing, what they were searching, you know, like one guy's opening the refrigerator. He's like, it's just nuts, you know? And then it was really comical. I would love to watch that video sometime. And then after we did it our way, he said, okay, try it this way. And then we did it, and do you know that we found those bodies in there in like a quarter of the time? And the searches were so much more efficient. And this is, I don't think we had thermal imaging cameras because this was 1995. So this is without cameras. But they videoed us, you know, and you could see, like, wow, like we were much more efficient by keeping a guy at the door with his flashlight, making some noise, like, hey, I'm here, and directing the search. And controlling that door, as opposed to three of us just going in and, you know, let's all go. It's like off to the races, you know.
So think about that, right? You get a good fire, right? And you leave someone at the door, and you're able to search better. You're able to be a little bit more calm, right? So you think about the mental performance, right? We talked about, you know, that's a big initiative in the FDNY now. Bringing a greater awareness to the mental part of firefighting. And you're able to, you know, and it's about going off the backside of the curve where you lose control of your thinking process and you have to kind of recenter yourself. Well, that firefighter at the door at a real serious fire kind of does that for you, right? He's talking to you. He's almost talking you through it like a good officer does. It enables you to stay in the optimal zone to work. Right. Now that we look back at that, we can see that there are benefits. But what's the problem? Who wants to stay at the door?
No one wants
Everybody
to stay at
wants
the door.
To
That's it.
Right.
They won't go to metal.
So,
yeah.
You know, which is great, right? Our firefighters are can-do people, action-orientated, A-type personalities, you know, which is great.
Yeah.
But it's time we need that operational discipline where somebody actually maintains the position at the door for the betterment of the entire team and the operation.
Yeah. You know what? You know, it is, frankly, it's kind of the way it is in the fire service. You know, in the engine, everyone wants the nozzle, but someone has to take the control. In the truck, everyone wants to have the irons, but someone has to take the roof. You know, when you do a roof rope rescue, one guy has to lower, the other guy swings. I mean, that's how the fire service is. And, you know, you're right. It's this type A, like, you know, no one wants to be that guy that lowers. No one wants to be the control man. No one, you know, but do you know, look at though, when you talk about a good control man, a control firefighter, right? So I've seen stretches, man, like where I come in, like as the all hands chief and I just scratch my head. I'm like, what were they thinking? You know what I mean? It's just like the hose is everywhere. I mean, they're stuffing it wherever they can find an opening, you know, and a good control firefighter could size that up and say, okay, you know what, the fire's on the fourth floor, it's one length to the door, another length into the building. That's two. We got a well. Maybe it's another three. I always throw one extra one for good luck. So maybe we'll use five or six on this one instead of 12, you know. And you just think about it. I mean, it's an unsung hero, right? I mean, even though he doesn't get the – he didn't put the fire out. He's not the nozzle man. But you know what? Because of his preciseness in mapping out that stretch, that fire went like clockwork. And it's the same with the roof.
A good control firefighter that knows what he's doing is worth his weight in gold.
Yeah, but he don't get the credit, Frank. That's the whole thing. The nozzle man gets
no,
the
and,
in the back.
No, and he likely doesn't want to be doing that position, even though it's important.
Right.
Right? We're all action-orientated,
right.
And that's what I want, right?
Right.
I don't want to come in for the night tour and everybody say they want the control, right? I mean,
right.
I want firefighters that want the nozzle, that want to do that. And but they know the importance of the control position and that it's the nozzle team. Right, I was at a drill the other night, and the firefighter running the drill was very passionate about it, and he's talking about the nozzle team, right? He's like, "You're the nozzle firefighter, you're the backup firefighter, and you're the control firefighter, but we're nothing if we're not a team, right?"
Mm.
And that
right.
is so incredibly accurate, right?
Mm.
And just getting that point across that hey, man, this is the way. This is the way it operates. We all want the nozzle, but guess what? You know, we all can't have the nozzle every time. But your part, your piece is critically important to the success of the total operation.
Yeah. So we could segue right into this next one. Never open the nozzle on smoke. Smoke is fuel. Man, have I seen that change. I remember, when I came on a job, you know, having the can, married to the can for 4 or 5 years, I mean, it was just like, you know, I remember like being able to put out a room of fire with a can. Like that was just normal. Like the officer, all right, Danny, get that can over here and boom, you put your finger over the nozzle, you knock it down, you close the door and, you know, that's it. Now, I had a fire. I was a captain. So this had to be about 13, 14 years ago. And this thing was cranking. I mean, it was unbelievable. It was an H-type. And there was a probe he had to can. And he went in, and when they came out and told us where the fire was, he looked like he had about 30 years on the job. His helmet was like it was black. You know what I mean? Like his everything was just black, you know, and the smoke was so thick that, like, it looked like it was going to light up at any point. And I basically told the nozzle man just to open the nozzle because it was so hot and there was no visible fire, but I knew, you know, what I used to call it. I used to have a name for it. I used to call it flammable smoke, I think. I used to have my own term for it because I used to see it, like, all the time. And I would just have the nozzle
man
just hit the ceiling.
And now we call that black fire, right? Now
black
that's black fire
yeah.
where it's just – It just needs, it needs a little bit more oxygen, and it's gonna, and it's not gonna be black fire anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember.
You know, and we absolutely have to open up on that.
I remember having the can and going down some hallways, and you look up into the ceiling, you could see these like little flickers of orange, like they would just kind of peek their head out, you know. And we didn't know anything about this flammable smoke back then, you know. So you just ignored it, but you know, a few years later when I became an officer, we started talking about using a can to kind of cool down overhead. That flammable smoke, you know. So that smoke is fuel. And
especially in the modern fire environment, right? I mean, so what is burning has, as you mentioned, right, changed since you come on the job and it's continued to evolve, which is why we get the amount of particles in here, because it's not burning efficiently, the amount of energy that a pound of plastics has compared to a pound of wood is significantly different.
It's double.
And
it's like double.
And you just have to know that, right? And there's a lot of stored energy, and we simply it doesn't get enough oxygen in a structure, so it starts to go into that ventilation limited stage with modern contents much earlier than it would. And we, like you mentioned, we have to put, you know, we have to put water on that. You know, we always knew that those, when we saw those little flickers of flame, that was pullover, and that was going to be followed by flashover if we didn't do anything. But we didn't put water on that, because if you put water on smoke, when I came on the FDNY in 1992, if I would have put water on smoke, my officer would not have given me the nozzle again for a very long time. So there was no way I was going to open it on smoke. But the fire environment has changed, and our knowledge of the fire environment has changed as well. And that's the key. That's one of the key takeaways of the boot camp.
Yeah. You know, I had a fire. It was a basement fire. And I was actually, I don't know if I was the all-hands chief or if I had the fire now. I'm going to have to say I probably was the all-hands chief, because I wouldn't have been in the rear yard, you know. And the engine came, and, you know, it's like this stairway going down into the basement. And the fire is at like three windows, you know. And I said to the officer, I said, do me a favor, hit it from here. Just give it a shot, you know. And they gave it a shot, you know, and they knocked down, and then they went down, you know. I got some grief after that. I know the truck was, like, not happy. They're like, you know, you shouldn't have done that. You know, what if you would have pushed the fire on us? And I'm like, listen, it was right there, man. You know, I'm saving these guys from getting their brains kicked in from going down the stairs, you know. So this was probably about.
And again, right? So as we've evolved, that's a while ago. So as our knowledge of our tactics has evolved with the help of a lot of the researchers and especially the research that UL has done, we know when we can and can't, you know, put water in those situations. And, you know, I use like the exterior water. It's a tactic of opportunity. There's times, right, and you mentioned it in your well-written article about, you know, quick water is good water. And whether that's coming in from a doorway, sometimes it's going to be from a window, whichever is going to get us, that's going to save us some time in the long run. You know, we have, in the FDNY, we have staffing that affords us the opportunity to, most of the time, go inside and put the fire out in a very, very timely fashion and rescue the occupants there in a timely fashion, where the exterior water stream, while it's obviously still a tactic, it's more of a tactic of for our second hose line or our third hose line, depending on the location of where the fire is. So if we have a delay with that first line, that second line could be in position as a tactic of opportunity. But that's because we need NFPA 1710, which is the standard for career departments, on the number of firefighters that they say that you should have on the scene of a working building fire.
Yeah.
So
was it 20,
without
Frank?
That, we wouldn't be able to do, what was that?
Was it 20, I think, right? 19 or 20? I'm not sure.
Well, there's 1710 and 1720. So 1710 is the career, and the 1720 is the volunteer.
Right.
You know, the
standard. No, I was just wondering. It's one of the
few standards.
The number of firefighters. Yeah. I thought the number of firefighters was 20.
So there's three different categories, and one is for private dwelling fires. One is for, like, the seven-story fire, seven, and then the other is for high-rise. But it changed in the latest version. So I don't want to give you the
That's fine.
You know, the wrong number on that.
Yeah, no worries. We're kind of coming down to the end of our time. So I wanted to tell this quick story. So a good friend of mine, Anthony Sacavino, who's now a deputy, he was in my study group for deputy, and he had a job on 149th and Park. He was working in the 14th Battalion. I know the building very well. It's a 40-story building, and it was like the fire was on the third floor, and the first new engine was like an extremely aggressive company, Squad 41. I mean, it was like, you know, they were first new, and they couldn't even get down the hallway. It was so much fire. They were storing, I think, plastic bins. The woman had these, like, storage bins. They were plastic, you know. So I know the building very well. It's like a federal building, right? So it had sheetrock. And it also had, in the hallways, interior hallways, they had these vents, right? So the smoke was able to travel through the whole building. So people were hanging babies, literally hanging babies out windows, you know. And, you know, Anthony was at his wit's end, you know, and there's a courtyard, and he was looking at the fire. It was up on the third floor, and one of the engine companies, 83, happened to be there, and he says, give it a shot with the 2.5. He gave it a shot with the 2.5. They put the fire out in about 5 seconds, in through the window. Like,
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
Like, they couldn't even get out of the stairway. The hallway was so hot, you know, and he just directed them to open the nozzle into the window. And that was it. It was out, like, and he said, Danny, it went out so fast, your head would spin, how fast it went out. So,
so I like this
yeah,
setting.
Absolutely.
We give you 180 gallons a minute to get 50.
Right. That's right. That's
you know?
What we need. So,
yeah.
All right. So, I think we pretty much covered all the big stuff. So anyway, we've got about 5 minutes left. I'm going to just put one more shout out if anyone wants to ask you any questions. If you want to speak with Deputy Assistant Chief Lieb, the number is 760-454-8852. And any questions, you know, myself or Frank would be happy to answer it for you. So we've got about 5 minutes left, Frankie. So unfortunately right now I am kind of laid up. I don't have many injuries since I've been on the job, but I have this L4. It's impinging on my herniated disc on my nerve. So it's got me laid up for like the last few weeks or so, and I think I'm probably going to be out for a little while. So I think I could count on one or two hands, I think, how many times I've had medical leave in 34 years. So I'm not really used to this. It's not where I want to be right now. But as far as the academy, though, I've been out, so I haven't really seen what's going on, but I'm hearing a lot of good things about all the changes, and I guess we're due for some probies at some point, I would imagine, in the coming few months.
We're hoping to get some probies at some point. That's going to be based on the finances of the city and
right.
The ability to get ready to go into the fire academy, and of course then we're ready to handle them as far as safety from COVID. We're ready for that, but once the powers that be say that they want to have probies, we'll be ready.
So my which is a leading question, so what is probies still going to look like for in this COVID world? Like for a guy that has like no experience, like he's a journeyman, he's an apprentice, you know.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
It'll be a challenge. So one of the first things we'll do is the class size is going to be significantly smaller. So the class sizes are smaller, and we can maintain social distancing, all that type of stuff. We're looking at adding additional classroom space. Possibly some outside. We're looking into the possibility of maybe building some pavilions that we can have for a three-season classroom if necessary. And just looking at, staggered schedules, there's lots of different things that that we're looking to do. So speaking of COVID, some of the things that we have changed, right? So we use this as an opportunity to – we had facilities – make us sinks. So we have portable sinks that we can move around the fire academy. So our members can wash their hands more frequently. So obviously that'll prevent the spread of COVID. But equally important, if not more important, is that's also gonna minimize our contamination and our spread of soot and fire ground contaminants. So it's little things like that we can have. There's a synergistic effect to things like that.
Gotcha. Right. So going to be some challenging times ahead of us with the probies trying to, get them acclimated to, the fire service. And, and then once they leave the fire academy now, with the the fire service the way it is now. It's just it's going to be just more onus on the officer to you know and work with the academy on just getting these guys you know constantly trained. You know.
Yeah, and we're lucky. Only, we have some smart people working on it, trying to come up with the best policies. I'm fortunate that you know I work under Brendan McSweeney, who's the chief of training, and Brian Fink, who I know you know well, is working with us as well, and Pat Williams, who's our chief of Proby School. So we have a good team, you know, trying to figure out you know what our best way forward is to you know to get probies in and keep them safe as well as our field units.
Right. I guess we'll finish on this note, which I'm a big fan of, is that they rotated the firefighters not for a year, so it's not a full rotation, but they're going to at least get to see some exposure in another borough, or I guess the engine guys going to a truck or the truck guys going to engines. I'm not sure how that's working, but
yeah, so you had it right. So basically, if you were assigned to an engine, you went, you know, that firefighter went to a ladder company, and if you were in a ladder, you went to an engine, and in a different borough. Yeah. So you would get, you know, a diverse experience, something different. You know, a firefighter that was in Lower Manhattan is now in South Jamaica, Queens.
Yeah.
You know, so very different.
It's
from
good.
A high-rise to a private dwelling environment.
You know, I have to tell you, I mean, I feel like sometimes I'm a hypocrite when I say this. I was very fortunate and blessed that I went to a truck company. I went to, you know, it was kind of active. And, you know, I got a lot of experience with the can and stuff. But in hindsight, you know, in reality, I know I think it was 1978, they didn't allow any probies to go to truck companies. They all went to engine companies. And, you know, being an officer in an engine company, both a lieutenant and a captain, you know, I look back and I'm like, wow, did I miss something? Because, you know, in my mind, I felt much tighter with the guys in the engine than I did with the truck. Even though I was pretty tight with the truck, but I mean, when you're a lieutenant and you have like three guys with you, and you're going down this hallway and you're taking on the dragon. You know what I mean? It's like this, I don't know what you call it, like agape, they call it. It's like this love. It's not, I don't know how to describe it, but it's just like this bond that, like, you're bonded, you know. And I see some of my guys now through the years, and I could think of a fire. I was with a fire with this guy. And, like, we were together. You know what I mean? Like, we were united as one, you know. And that's something I, you know, being in the truck, I mean, the closest I came to that was having the can and, you know, but I have to tell you, there's a lot to be said for that engine. And I chose to be an officer. I was an engine officer for, let's say, probably 12 years, you know. And I love being an engine officer. So I'm glad that this is a good thing, this rotation, because it's gonna open up these truckies' their eyes a little bit, you know, and see what it's really all about, you know, what it's like to be in the engine. Anyway, Frank.
Yeah, I agree.
I can't thank you
enough.
I
agree. It's definitely beneficial. Hey, I just want to quickly clarify one of the things with the staffing for NFPA 1710. So you had asked me about it, right? So it was 15 in the previous standard for private dwellings. I believe that's now 16, 28 for the mid-rise, and it was 43 plus firefighters for the high-rise. So that would explain why a lot of our Manhattan companies have five firefighters, because of the requirements of 1710 for the number of firefighters you need. So I just wanted to clarify that. We spoke about that earlier, and I looked it up because I should know
that'll,
if I'm on that standard.
That'll be a whole nother episode, Frankie. I'll have to bring you back for another discussion on staffing sometime, because everyone, when you go out to FDIC, they're so jealous that we have all these guys, and I could tell them sometimes, you know what, be careful what you ask for, because sometimes trying to manage 40 guys in a private dwelling is not an easy thing. So I just want to put it out there. The boss asked me to talk about the conference, the United Fire Conference in September, that it's on, and seating is limited. So if you were planning on going, you might want to inquire sooner than later, because I don't think it's going to be open-ended. And that being said, Frank, again, thank you very much for being on the show. It was a real pleasure. I'm always honored to be able to talk with you and talk about what we love. And until then, guys, be safe, and see you next time on the radio.
Thanks, Dan. Always a pleasure to be on.
Thanks, Frankie.